Socrates, the contemplative life, the attainment of the various cathartic disciplines, the relaxation of man's pressures, the overcoming of selfishness and personal intensities, and the cultivation of the noble and serene life of wisdom. These things cause a separation between the soul and the body, by which the soul is permitted to be clarified, to become the ruler of the body or the master of it, and is given dominion over the corporeal nature and its limitations. Thus it is said that by death, the body is violently separated from the soul. But by initiation into the mysteries, the soul is gently separated from the body. And the difference becomes essentially part of the old rituals. If then we consider the hero to be the spirit purpose, the will of man, resolved to rescue his own soul from its subterranean abode, we can see why, entering into the regions of Sarastro, that the drama should be concluded by what appears to be an irrelevant ceremony. In the original form of the story, there seems no reason why the rescuing of Pamina should result in a ritual of initiation. It is not particularly indicated as necessary. The point, of course, is that there is no way out of the underworld without the mystery of initiation. There are only two ways out of matter: violent through death, gentle through wisdom. That which is violent, however, is a separation of the body from the soul, but is not in any sense a relieving of the soul of the burden of worldliness. Death takes man out of the world, but initiation takes worldliness out of the man, and these two are vastly different things. Buddha points this out in his Doctrine of Rebirth, stating that the loss of body has no essential effect upon consciousness, for consciousness must be rescued by a direct act of volition and not by an accident of death. In other words, death is the common accident of man, but immortality is attained only by a purposeful intent and is never attained accidentally. And again we can remember the lines from Faust: how closely linked are luck and merit. Doth never to the fool occur at either wise man's stone. I swear it, the stone had no philosopher. And that is the concept again in the Magic Flute. So in spite of the fact that probably neither the hero nor the heroine had given any particular consideration to the matter, Sarastro, as master of the mysteries, realizes that the only escape of these two into the philosophic empire is by the mystery of initiation. And it is also only in that way that they can overcome the temporal power of the Queen of the Night. And the Queen of the Night, to the very end, seeks to frustrate this end, because representing mortality, she also presents her demands. And her demands are that man shall leave this world only by death, indicated by the presentation of the dagger. The Queen of the Night also wishes to dispose of the high priest, Sarastro, who stands between her and her physical control of the universe. For there is only one thing that stands between mortality, as we know it, and the mortal state, and the attainment of self-illumination or discipline, and that is the ritual of initiation, represented and impersonated in the Hierophant of the Mysteries. For the master of the secret of the transformation from one world to another is the Adept King, the Hierophant, or the Initiate Priest. He is the possessor of wisdom, and wisdom forms the living bridge or ladder by which man ascends out of the world of darkness. And the song of wisdom, the glory of it, the importance of it, and to a degree its social significance, will be found in the lines given to Sarastro in the opera. So Sarastro, as the initiator, becomes again Gurnemanz, the old knight, the Merlin of King Arthur, everywhere the principle of wisdom, which is to lead these two young people through the mysteries of darkness and ignorance to the final attainment of a spiritual security. The power of Monostatus, the black Moor, or the adversary, is said in this analogy to represent the lower emotional body of man. So we now have a series of factors in which appetite, greed, and ambition, the physical propensities of man, seek to also control the soul, to adapt the energy of the soul to their own purpose. In other words, the dark Moor seeks to possess the soul for itself. This is also carried in another way in the story of Samson, who is, of course, a symbol of the Sun Man, the young hero prince, as in the operatic story. This Samson is blinded and bound to the millstone of the Philistines, which represents psychic energy or spiritual strength or force, bound to materialism and caused to perform the physical activities of a materialistic way of life. Therefore, whenever we speak of ambition, whenever we speak of schemes, stratagems, conspiracies, and spoils, whenever we think of men who, like Cassius, have a lean and hungry look, we are recognizing the perversion of soul power, in which the psychic strength of human nature has been caused to enter a state of bondage with the lower emotional nature, so that the psychic powers of man are used to injure man, hurt man, or destroy man through selfishness. The soul, thus bound to the lower world, would be said to be captured by the black Moor. However, Sarastro, wisdom, will not let this take place. And whenever the Moor thinks he has accomplished his end, Sarastro, or true wisdom, works a conspiracy which frustrates it. Thus man, in his search for reality in the ritual drama, has the devil's advocate, but he also has the faithful guide and leader, his Virgil, who is to conduct him and assist him through the mysteries of the underworld. The magic flute, of course, abridges somewhat into two the great initiation rites of the elements. These initiation rites are found not as much in the very early sources as they are in the later restorational material. During the period from about the rise of Kabbalism in Spain, under the Moors, by the way, through the Rosicrucian Hermetic cycle, into the Illuminists, and finally into the works and rituals of St. Germain and Cagliostro, we find the initiation of the four elements taking quite a place, and very shortly after the publication of the Life of Sethos, there was an important Masonic text issued which also described these initiation rites, and they are found in the Krater Rapport, another fanciful restoration of the Egyptian mysteries. These represented the passage of the neophyte through the four elements to represent victory over earth, which is the physical life, water, which is the vital or psychic life, fire, which is the emotional nature, and air, which is the mental principle. These four initiations, therefore, are man learning to control the four vehicles or bodies which he has at his disposal, the physical, vital, emotional, and mental bodies. His victory over these bodies is achieved by his victory over the principles which they represent. The victory over materialism is therefore the initiation of earth, represented primarily, usually, by the subterranean location and sometimes by the burial in a stone sarcophagus, which is appropriate to the principal symbolism of earth. Transition through water, or the crossing of a flooded stream, or as in the case of the Druid initiate Taliesin, who is sent out to sea in an open boat without oars, which he must control by his will. The initiation by water represents the purification of the vital principle, as representing particularly the purification of the generative power of man. The initiation of fire, represented in this rite by a long passageway filled with smoke and flames and combustion, but variously depicted in other rituals, indicates man's control of the intensities of his emotional and desire natures. Here he must fight with the fire within himself, the fire of hate, the fire of anger, the fire of lust, the fire of temper. All of these things must be subdued, because unless man controls these emotions, he cannot have ultimate victory. Lastly, the initiation of air either takes place upon some highly mountainous region, or involves a motion through the air, a teleportation, or being carried, like the Chinese immortal, from this world to the other on a cloud. There is always the initiation of air. In the Sigurd saga, it was the dead hero being carried to Valhalla on the horse of the Valkyrie, flying through the air. The air element was the principle of mind, or thought, and the subduing or overcoming of the mental nature and the mental instincts constituted victory over the element of air, because it was this air which, by its vacillation, its inconstancy, and its inability to attain a state of discipline or settledness, its abstraction, its invisibility, like thought itself, caused man to have great difficulties in controlling it, directing it, mastering it, and finally dedicating it to the purposes of the mysteries. In the magic flute, only two of the four initiations are clearly set forth, although the others are represented by the subterranean world, and finally the luminous pageant with which the drama terminates. The two initiations of fire and water are reminiscent of the baptisms referred to in the New Testament. For John the Baptizer baptized with water, but the one who came after him, who was preferred before him, baptized with the Holy Spirit, which is fire. So baptism by fire and water is also very carefully perpetuated in the ritual as it was originally shown at the time of the initiation of Abraham by Melchizedek, Prince of Salem. For in this case, we have the baptism by corn, wine, and oil, or bread, or grain, wine, and oil. In the Last Supper of Jesus, we have the wine and the bread. And someone has said, what has happened to the oil, which was necessary to the ancient ritual of Melchizedek? The anointing of the head with oil. And of course the answer lies that the word Christ from Christos, Christo, means oil. Therefore Christ himself was the oil, and he also completed the sacrament with the bread and wine and restored or restated the sacrament of Melchizedek. So the initiation in the two elements, as represented in the opera, represent purification by fire and water. Purification by fire, the higher of the two rites, represented the purification of the soul or psychic nature, and by water, the purification of the body or the material nature. Water was the symbol of cleanliness, the cleanness of both the body, the soul, and all of its attributes. By fire, we have the initiation of inspiration, or the individual cleansing and purifying the higher or spiritual parts of his own nature. So body was purified by water, soul was purified by fire. That is why in the legends of both the Sigurd Saga and the Arthurian epic, we have the sword representing will or spirit, which is tempered upon the anvil and is made to be true steel by passing through the mystery of fire. Fire, therefore, tempers the sword of will and gives it the strength or the keenness for the labors for which it is intended. Having successfully passed through the ordeals of fire and water, the young couple, now representing the amalgam of spirit and soul, or of the higher and lower psychic natures, or the androgene anima animus within man, are then led together into the presence of the great court of the priest of Osiris. In this situation also, we have had an experience of changing worlds. For in passing into the great throne room, or the wonderful place of the mysteries, the candidate has ascended the sacred spiral staircase, the staircase of evolution with its 3, 5, and 7 steps, and has come finally to the gate of the celestial splendors. He has therefore passed through the gate of Capricorn, which was to the ancients the gate of death. But his death has been symbolical rather than literal, because in the initiation ritual of all peoples, the higher degrees always parallel and correspond to the mortuary rites. It is that the individual is dying to an old life, or to an old way of life. His rebirth is the symbol of the resurrection of consciousness from body. It is the restoration of the glory of the soul. It is the soul that has now achieved conscious freedom from the enmeshments of the body. And in the alchemical mysteries, this is represented by Christ rolling away the stone of the tomb and rising, bearing in his hands the symbol of the elixir of life and the philosopher's stone. Thus, the restoration, or the rolling away of the stone, is the result of the spiritual life of man and is the mystery of the second birth. This again parallels the Greek ritual, because when the initiate, having completed the higher degrees of the Eleusinian rite, came forth between the columns of the temple to receive the plaudits of the people, he was hailed as one who was dead and who has been reborn. Part of this ritual, incidentally, remains in the story of the prodigal son, which is another story of exactly the same principle. And when the prodigal son returns to his father's house and the offerings and the feasts are prepared for him, the father says, "For my son who was dead is alive again." And yet the story does not imply physical death. It is a distinct statement of the mysteries. For that which descends into the flesh pots of Egypt and wastes its substance in riotous living is said to die. Therefore, Plato points out that birth into materialism is death, and death from materialism into enlightenment is birth, and all of the other is of seeming, whereas this is of being, or of true reality. It was consequently customary in the Greek period and in the Egyptian period to refer to an initiate as one twice born, or thrice born. For man is first born from the womb of his mother, and is the second time born from the womb of the mysteries, or the alma mater, the mother of wisdom. And this thought, of course, is conveyed in the Hermetic tradition, where Hermes is referred to as the thrice-born one, or the thrice-greatest, and in honor of that was given the title Trismegistus, meaning the thrice-greatest, or the thrice-born one. So the young couple, representing the reborn spiritual life of man that has passed successfully through the testing of the initiations and rites, the couple is then brought into the presence of Seraspro, who, representing reason, illumination, knowledge, is also the personification of the secret doctrine itself. He bears in his hand a tall scepter-like staff, surmounted by a golden orb, and from this golden orb, rays of light in the form of golden lines spread out and form a kind of nimbus. He is therefore a symbol of the spiritual sun, the same one that is described by Apuleius in his Metamorphoses, where he says he saw the sun shining at midnight. in the ritual of the mysteries. The Sarastro, therefore, now becomes the symbol of the sun in the midst of the glorious universe of truth. His temple, his world, represents the new age, the coming world, the world of light, and also the restored kingdom of truth upon the earth. And it is to the Illuminists and some of this group that we are indebted for this very interesting and powerful concept. Namely, that the so-called kingdom of heaven is actually symbolical of the kingdom of brotherly love, or human fraternity, which is established here on earth, and the establishment of which is the goal of the great system of the mysteries, and has been this goal since the dawn of time. In other words, the great throne room in which the final rituals are given represents perfected human society, ruled over by the philosopher king, dominated by the reign of reason, perfect in all things, and in passing, Weishaupt's great concept of the restoration of education through the restoration of the mysteries and the great systems of spiritual apprenticeship. Now, the name of the story, of course, the name of the opera, is derived from the magic flute. Therefore, perhaps we should pause for just a moment and see what all this flute is about. Because, like the musical instrument of Orpheus, it seems to have an interesting history. The Orphic lyre had seven strings. The magic flute had seven notes. And this flute is, of course, the same one that is carried by Krishna in India, and upon which he plays the mysterious melodies which charm the gopis and cause the shepherd maidens to dance in their circle of 12 around him, as symbolical of the zodiac moving in its sacred dance around the sun. This also is the mysterious instrument of Shiva, for either as a flute or as a veena with seven stops or frets upon it, this instrument, according to the Hindus, represented the monochord, or the great chain of vibratory harmonics that unites heaven and earth. Pythagoras describes it as the monochord of the world, with its lower end placed in the element of earth and its upper end at the sphere of the fixed stars, and the orbits of the planets and elements as frets dividing the cord. So that from these divisions came the great harmonic and enharmonic intervals of music. This music of the spheres, this mysterious musical instrument, has a number of interesting meanings. One of the most simple of these meanings, of course, is the human spinal cord, with its seven mysterious tones, or chakras, or gates, through which energy ascends and descends, as in the legend of Jacob's ladder. In the ritual of this story, therefore, the base of the spine and the lower part of man's body would represent the underworld in which the lower initiations are given, whereas the dome temple of the skull, in the midst of which is the ventricular opening of the brain with its priestly symbols posited there, as in the story of Parsifal, would represent the ascent of the spinal spirit fire in man by means of the double system. This double system is a very interesting and curious thing, for through the spinal cord itself, through the sixth ventricle, moves the Shashumna Nadi, which begins at the base of the spine as the serpent of evil that must be slain, and later ascends through this spinal cord to be referred to apparently. Now, this is a possible extension of meaning, but it seems to be indicated. Namely, that this is the mysterious Christos, or fire power, which, if it be lifted up, shall draw all men unto it. This, apparently, is the reference of St. Paul. Now, the rising of the Shashumna Nadi is accompanied by another phenomenon. And this phenomenon is the restoration or stimulation of the autonomic nervous system, represented by two other channels or two other forces referred to in Indian philosophy as the Ida and Pingala, or the black and white serpents that twist through and form parts of the psychic nervous system of the human being. these two, or this autonomic system, which is raised with the spinal system, with the cerebral system, may also be likened to the soul ganglia. And in this way, the rise of the Shashumna Nadi rescues the soul, which it draws with it upward into the great mystery temple of initiation, where Sarastro, representing the Brahma power in the brain, receives these two and unites them in an eternal hermetic marriage. Thus, the human body and its more esoteric symbolism becomes also involved in the story of the magic flute. And at this stage of it, I cannot but pause to give a little bit of anecdotage here that might be of passing interest. The last time I saw the opera at the Metropolitan in New York, the two people sitting in front of me evidently were not opera lovers. I suspect that someone couldn't come and gave the tickets to friends. Because throughout the evening, these two wiggled around in their seats, were struggling with the English synopsis, trying to find out what was happening. And when they finally came to the great scene of the union of the two at the end, where the prince and princess are brought into spiritual union by Sarastro, the gentleman turned to the lady beside him and in a hoarse whisper said, "Why didn't they get married in the first act and let us all go home?" This type of situation is typical in opera, as in the case of the forging of the sword Nothung in Siegfried, in which I was privileged to hear someone not far away remark, "When will that blacksmith get finished?" High art, of course, has its devotees, but it is also quite uncomfortable. And when we are mentioning the discomforts of fine art, let us remember Papageno, to whom the whole problem of the magic flute was just that uncomfortable, and who represents that type of mankind which is capable of going through the ceremony of initiation without noticing it, without ever discovering that it happened, and who can reach the end of life saying that life is successful or unsuccessful only in terms of whether it has been comfortable or uncomfortable. And there are millions, therefore, who resemble him, even though the feathers are not visible. In the final scene, of course, we have the hermetic union. This is the marriage of the sun and moon, or the creation of the complete homunculus, or spiritual being, within the consciousness of man. Here we have the polarized opposites uniting in eternal union to produce the spiritualized and intuitive power of man's over-perception. The Greeks and Egyptians both agreed that when the energies of man, through discipline, through enlightenment, through method, through various procedures, more or less reminiscent of Eastern doctrines, but also in the West, obtainable by pure consecration, by the gradual unfoldment and development of spiritual apperceptive powers, that when this union is finally consummated, man becomes truly human. Up to that time, he is only potentially human. He does not attain to his ultimate and complete humanity until, according to the ancients, he had received initiation. The ancient sacred number was 12. And this number corresponded to the divisions of the circle, or the great cycle of the labors of Hercules, which we call the zodiac. Man at birth is born after 9 months of prenatal conditioning and preparation. For this reason, the Chinese celebrate his first birthday when he is 3 months old, because to them, the prenatal epoch is part of the first year of life. But man, it is said, to achieve true birth must pass through 9 months in the womb of his mother and 3 degrees in the womb of the mysteries. For this reason, the ancient rites were nearly always divisible into 3 primary degrees. And these degrees represented man's ultimate mastery over the material, psychical, and spiritual mysteries of his own existence. He thus became master of body, soul, and mind, or body, mind, and spirit, according to the divisions of a particular group. But the same implication is always involved. Man, by the mysteries, becomes human. He becomes human in the fact that there is then no deficiency left within him, and that his purposes, his ideals, his principles, his understanding are all truly human. And the Greeks, Egyptians, and Hindus have given us certain definitions of this human state. That man as a human being must abide in a world unique to himself. He can no longer accept the illusion of matter. He can no longer be controlled by the elements of the physical world. He is described as living in the world, but not of it, because he has discovered that his true destiny and his true nature lies not in the achievement of material things, but in the perfection and unfoldment of his own internal resources. Therefore, the true man is the man who lives to grow, to serve, to do, whereas the ignorant or mortal man is the one who lives to accumulate and exploit and variously pervert the universal energies around him in life. So the animal man abuses, the human being, the true human being, uses, and by right use, sustains and justifies his own humanity. So actually, the mysteries were not conceived as producing essentially super people. They were not really producing a higher order, actually, because this higher order was the true man. And we find this in the German mysteries and the German mystics, where we find the references to the man of earth and the man of heaven. And we find in the writings of Behme the reference to the two Adams. That Adam, which is the parent of our mortality, and the second Adam, which is the parent of our immortality. And these are called the light and dark Adams, and they occur again in the rituals of the Kabbalah. For as Adam is the progenitor of mortal man from Adamus the species, so the second Adam is the progenitor of the spiritual man. And the second Adam is the initiate adept. He is the symbol of the one who is to be the teacher and redeemer and progenitor of the spiritual life of man. These peoples, therefore, possessed what they believed and held to be certain secret arts and sciences, which were communicated by degrees only. And this progressive science of human regeneration constituted the substance of the mysteries. And it was this substance that Adam Weishaupt wished to restore at the basis of the educational system of Europe. He had no way of realizing that the age of the mysteries was gone. And the young intellectuals at Ingolstadt who were seeking this same inspiration were not able to judge the weight of opposition or the terrible pressures of the political and social times in which they lived. The noble experiment did not succeed, but it left certain monuments and certain records beyond and behind it. And these monuments became of the gravest concern to tyrants, causing a century of effort to be made to wipe out every vestige again of this restoration of the mysteries in Europe. It was not possible or considered desirable to wipe out the magnificent music of Mozart or the wonderful opera which he built around this concept. It was very simple, therefore, simply to ignore or to deny its content. Let it remain as a magnificent piece of music. Let it remain as a fantasy, a wonderful tale drawn out of the Arabian Nights of the human mind, but not to remember or to recall that it was founded upon a great political experiment and that Mozart himself was working for this very end, that man, humanity, the young prince and princess, should be led together to liberty, led to a better way of life, led to an opening of universal opportunity, and that ultimately the reign of wisdom would be established in the world. This was attempted in the French Revolution, but failed. It was also attempted in the American Revolution. But the secret and priceless heritage of this experiment is still obscure, although we have constant evidence and consistent reminders that there was a purpose and a plan behind the formation of our Western way of life. We know that at one time George Washington was concerned over the Illuminist problem. And there were a number of groups in this country who used it as a political football. And during some of the early political campaigns involving John Adams and John Quincy Adams, it was rumored that the adversary was an Illuminist and therefore should not be under any condition elected to office. There was a scandal that lasted for about 15 or 20 years and brought some of the strongest wits of the time into play. Gradually, however, the entire matter faded from public attention and other purposes became more aggressively prominent. But the lodge of the Illuminists did linger and did have a part to play, and in one of our publications on the Masonic Orders of Fraternity, we point out how this Illuministic movement and related Masonic interests were largely responsible for the revolution in Latin America under Simon Bolivar, and the liberation of Italy under Giuseppe Garibaldi, and the liberation of Mexico under Miguel Hidalgo. All of these men were connected with what were called the Reading Societies. And these Reading Societies were Illuminist groups that actually were established in Latin America. So this pattern goes on and on. But perhaps there is no monument or document of it that has as much dramatic interest to us as the magic flute, because in it we are allowed to escape from the immediate political pressures of the 18th century and to sense perhaps the spiritual aspiration that was underneath all of this idea. And where and how could this spiritual aspiration be more adequately or beautifully set forth than in great music, which strikes directly into the inner life of the individual and reminds him of the great good that can be, that might be, if he man himself was able to accept it. So the mysterious world of Sarastro and his wonderful temples disappears into our kind of thin air. But that thin air is within ourselves as an attenuated spiritual atmosphere. And all of these great contributions continue subconsciously to impel us toward the fulfillment of our great spiritual need and destiny. Thus, he tells us in this opera that the mysteries as we knew them are gone, but that society itself is now the place of initiation, that in the conspiracies of states and nations, in the tyranny of despots, and in the constant struggle for human life, man is passing through the subterranean passages of an initiation rite. And he now has a very wonderful and all-sufficient guide and leader in the form of Sarastro. Increasing knowledge, universal education, the public school system, and all these things. Imperfect, certainly, but imperfect only because man is willing to permit them to be that way. Because Sarastro can be merely a demagogue, as he represents education. But if man will meet him, will retire into the rites and mysteries which he requires, wisdom will bestow its greater blessings. Man does not need to live upon the surface of knowledge any longer than he desires to. For the moment he has the necessary insight, he can penetrate that surface and come into the presence of greater and more noble realities and truths. All of this is set forth to remind man that beneath the surface of his living is a secret meaning, and that if he will seek this meaning and will demand of others around him, his leaders, those who represent him in various public relationships, if he will demand from these the high standard represented in the story of the magic flute, he can have it. But man must decide whether he is going to be the man or the mouse in this case. Perhaps more correctly, whether he will be the prince or Papageno, whether he will be willing merely to hunt for a mate and be satisfied completely with a physical existence, or and satisfied also to shake away evil with his sistrum or his little stick of bells, or whether he will actually seek solution. If he is willing to seek solution, he can find it. If he is willing to follow the ancient road shown by Sarastro in the temple and is willing to be led into the mysteries, he will then find beyond the better world the greater civilization, and he can build the restoration of the shrines of Isis and Osiris. These simply represent the shrines of truth everywhere available. Truth now hidden deeply, so-called underground, locked within the psychic life of man. So the final drama is the unfolding of the soul within man and its final emergence under the directing power of reason, so that finally within the heart and mind are the magnificent pageantries of this opera. All these different points and different systems and symbols have interest for us, and each must choose in his own way that which he considers most appropriate to his own need. But one thing I think we can say beyond any question of doubt, this is not a comic opera, nor was it intended primarily to amuse. It was intended to strike the conscience of the people of Austria, and later, the people of the world. We can paraphrase the famous lines of Hamlet in this case and say, the opera is the thing with which to catch the conscience of the king. In this case, the king was a queen, Maria Theresa. But the purpose of the opera was to catch the conscience of Austria and to cause this nation to become a leader in the spiritual life of Europe. It was satisfied, however, to play the part of Papageno and gave us some delightful waltzes by Strauss. It did not give us, however, the liberation, because Austria did not attain it. But it was Mozart's dream and hope that this country would lead the great restoration of learning. Actually, it did, but only in him. He became an imperishable monument to the dream which could have been Austria, but which was finally destroyed in the fall and collapse of the Habsburgs. But in Mozart, Austria lives. In Mozart also, the Illuminati found a name and a patron who has conferred upon them eternal honor. I think that is the subject for this evening.